You are listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Washington Island School District on the tip of Door County is the smallest in the state, with only 72 students enrolled from kindergarten through 12th grade. We'll find out how the district deals with the lack of state funding and geographic isolation. First, state schools superintendent and Democratic candidate for governor Tony Evers said yesterday that he was firing lawyers picked to represent him in a convoluted lawsuit. At issue is whether or not Evers broke state law by sidestepping Governor Scott Walker's administration in the administrative rulemaking process. Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He's here to untangle the situation. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
So administrative rules, not always the most exciting issue, but they've led to an interesting story here. But what administrative rules are we talking about here at the heart of this story?
Well, we're talking about the ability, basically, of the legislature to impose restrictions on administrative rules when it comes to the state superintendent's office. So administrative rules are the fine details of laws. They're written by experts at state agencies. Just the agency that's overseen by Tony Evers, the Department of Public Instruction, is different than other agencies. It's run by a constitutional officer in Evers, somebody who's elected statewide and is spelled out in the Constitution as having special powers. So the issue really in the lawsuit is whether they can restrict his ability to, you know, put those fine details into law where they have to run and pass the governor's office first.
Right. So the legislature put this restriction on state agencies in the executive branch, basically,
right,
saying you want a new rule, fine, to implement a law we've passed. Fine, but you've got to go through the governor to do this.
You have to...
Department of Administration.
In this latest rewrite that they did of administrative rules, they said if you're going to have an administrative rule, you have to send the scope statement first to the Department of Administration. The Department of Administration, we could say, right now is the Walker administration.
And then there's the Department of Public Instruction, run now by Tony Evers, uh-huh, elected, and as you said, a separate... constitutional position. It's defined in the Constitution, and Tony Evers and his department are saying, fine for you guys, this doesn't apply to us because we're a different constitutional entity.
Right, and he's not pulling that out of thin air either, because this issue has been out there before. There was a rewrite of administrative rules in 2011 by the Republican legislature, signed by Governor Walker, which restricted the ability of Tony Evers to, you know, write the rules that his agency wants. I mean, he essentially gave Walker veto power over rules from Tony Evers' Department of Public Instruction. That was challenged. That went all the way up to the state Supreme Court. The state Supreme Court said, no, legislature, you can't do this. It was an unusual decision in that you had a couple conservatives siding with a couple liberals to strike that down as it pertained to Tony Evers. But that was in 2016. And so that's in relatively, you know, recent history.
Now, a new lawsuit. Who's filing this lawsuit?
This is the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. It's a conservative law firm, think tank, and really big into school choice issues. And so they're often at odds with Evers.
And they're saying, let's have another go at this. We've got a new law. We've got a slightly different state Supreme Court.
They're stressing the new law, right? The legislature did this new rewrite of administrative rules. But you do have to look at the practical realities. One of the justices who said that the legislature couldn't do this when it came to Evers, Justice David Prosser, is no longer on the court. Another one of the conservative justices who said, you know, that was unconstitutional is leaving the court, Justice Michael Gableman. And so you're going to have different group of justices up there. And so, you know, it's a situation where it gives the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty a chance to give this another crack.
Talking to Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief, about a kind of sort of regulatory turf war in the state government with implications for the governor's race. And Sean, here's where it gets a bit funky. Tony Evers, his department is getting sued. He gets to be represented by a lawyer.
Right.
And that's where it gets weird. Who gets to represent him?
Yeah. And even weirder, because Tony Evers is not just state superintendent anymore. He is Tony Evers, Democratic gubernatorial candidate.
One of many.
But he in this case, you know, this issue affects him differently than it did in the first go round. And what's happening is Tony Evers is being, as it stands right now, would be represented by the State Department of Justice, which is run by Republican Attorney General Brad Schimel. The thing is, Schimel and the Department of Justice are on the same page of this Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. That is, they think that this lawsuit is actually correct. They agree that these new rulemaking changes apply to Evers. And so essentially they are representing Evers, but they disagree with his point of view.
Now, Tony Evers says, thanks, but no thanks. I don't want somebody representing me who's actually on the other side. Here he is this week talking about why he is saying he's firing the Department of Justice representing him.
The governor doesn't get to choose his opponents on the ballot and its opponents' lawyers in court. I can't believe there's many, if any, citizens in the state of Wisconsin that would feel comfortable going to court knowing that the attorney that's representing them actually represents the other side.
So Tony Evers says, nope, you're fired. I'm going to secure my own legal representation. Can he do that?
That is an open question. You know, it's one thing to say you're fired to the DOJ. Whether or not he can actually do that remains an open question. The Department of Justice says no. The direct quote from their spokesman was that Tony Evers is living in a fantasy world if he thinks that he can just fire them. But what Tony Evers wants to do right now is be represented by an attorney from his Department of Public Instruction instead. He referenced Governor Walker there. You know, obviously this is the political season has started. It never stops. But he's framing this as an issue where he's at odds with the governor. There's some truth to that in that Governor Walker could, you know, let Tony Evers hire outside counsel, but he's not doing that in this case. Governor Walker supports Tony Evers being represented by the Department of Justice.
And here's Governor Walker talking about that representation.
Well, you're entitled to a lawyer that represents everyone. And the fact of the matter is that the Justice Department represents all state agencies. They're not conflicted out. And so they're ultimately going to represent the state in this case, just like they would for any other state agency or any other office.
So are two attorneys going to show up in the courtroom, both claiming to represent Tony Evers? How does this get sorted out?
Well, so we've got this lawsuit, which follows another lawsuit, both of which involve the Supreme Court. What could happen potentially, and we don't know, but what could happen is that if Tony Evers wants to be represented by somebody else and the Department of Justice doesn't want that, that might have to go to the state Supreme Court too, potentially. This might be getting so convoluted at this point that they have to run that very question of who represents Tony Evers in this case up to the Supreme Court that would eventually be hearing this lawsuit, maybe.
So there would be a lawsuit over who got to represent one side in this other lawsuit.
It could be, yes.
Now let's talk about the politics of this. We've touched on this a little bit here. Governor Walker, we know, running for re-election. Tony Evers, we know, one of, I don't know, a dozen score Democrats running to challenge
Governor
Walker.
Where are we? Say, yeah.
But like a lot of people who are solid maybes,
right.
It sounds like, above and beyond that. So there's going to be a lot of political posturing surrounding this lawsuit, I would guess.
It's already begun, right? You had the group that brought this. I mean, you could say they have a fairly longstanding record of wanting to have more influence at the Department of Public Instruction. And one way of doing that would be to file a lawsuit like this. But they are filing it against Tony Evers, a Democratic candidate for governor, ahead of campaign season. Evers is not being quiet on this. He's not just, oh, let's work this out in court. He's coming out and saying, you're fired. You know, he's fundraising off of this too. He's sending out fundraising emails saying Scott Walker's not going to like this. So they're all trying to get an edge on this right now, even as we're, you know, a little less than a year away from Election Day.
In the meantime, there are going to be cases where Governor Walker and Tony Evers have to work together on educational issues over the next year and a half or so.
Maybe. I mean, they have in the past worked together on some educational stuff. But when it comes to administrative rules, those fine details of educational laws, right now, Tony Evers is saying those are my agency's decisions. The Constitution backs me up at this, and so does the state Supreme Court.
Any timeline on when things are going to hit court here?
I don't know. I mean, I think the way that they filed this lawsuit, they want to bypass the circuit court and go right to the state Supreme Court and have them take it as an original action. I don't know if they're going to do that. There's a lot of what ifs in this. And so I'm not sure what's going to happen there as far as timing goes.
Sean, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He is with us to talk about a lawsuit against state school superintendent and Democratic governor candidate Tony Evers. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Some people leave school and never look back. Others just can't stay away. College student Elise Shimke noticed an older couple auditing one of her classes and decided to find out more about them.
It's safe to say that for the nearly 45,000 students at UW-Madison, time spent on the Isthmus is a milestone. But scattered amongst crowds of Snapchatting 20-somethings, there's a smaller, silent population for whom education is a lifestyle, senior guest auditors. After 4 years of wondering, I decided it was time to ask an auditor to break their silence while I listened. I got twice what I bargained for when I met Marion Omer Jones in my last Shakespearean literature course. Married for 66 years, their often matching winter apparel and outstanding attendance record caught my eye. Do you have any idea how many courses?
Well, in the beginning it was two times the number of semesters, but that lasted a lot.
Probably about four semesters.
And after that it was one every semester. So you can sort of figure it out.
Two a year for at least 27 years, and then add about four more.
Okay, so how do you decide which courses to take? Do you sit down together and do it as a team effort?
Run a list and review those. And
we're not morning people.
Right.
So we like to take a course that it's at least after 12 o'clock.
To me, they sound like any other undergrad on campus. And as it turns out, Mary and Omer were once both undergrads at UW. Mary traveled from Oconto in 1945 to complete a degree in nursing. Omer, originally from Osseo, was returning to study accounting and later psychology after his more than 2 years of service in World War II.
We met, well, actually, I lived in a co-op dorm called Anderson House, and one of the people in the house was taking a German class, and Omer was in that class.
Yes.
At our co-op house, we had parties every now and then, and she brought Omer. And then when I went into nursing school, I had to come back the next summer early. And so I was at the dorm, and I was walking down the street after buying books or something. And I met Omer, and he said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "Oh, I'm just going to go back to the dorm and see if I can find somebody to go to a movie with me." And he said, "I'm available." So then we went to the movie together, and we started going together.
Upon her retirement in 1990, Mary promptly began auditing. She made sure to leave a seat in class for Omer, who followed her only weeks later.
We have other forms of entertainment, but instead of playing bridge or, you know, that sort of thing, we audit classes.
As possibly the most experienced students on UW's campus, I asked if they had any advice for students just setting out on their educational journeys.
Well, I always tell everybody, learn as much as you can. And I have never learned anything in my life that I eventually wasn't glad that I knew and that I could use it, and wished I had paid more attention to what was going on.
They have to realize that everything is connected to everything else.
That's right.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now we go from the college classroom to the state's smallest K-12 school district. The Washington Island School District on the tip of Door County has only 72 students enrolled, period, kindergarten through 12th grade. In 2015, just one senior made up the graduating class. Barry Adams covers regional and business news for the Wisconsin State Journal. He recently spent some time on Washington Island to see how the district has adapted to some of its unique challenges. Barry, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks, Rob.
Well, a lot of people in Wisconsin, if they think Washington Island, they think vacation. But can you give us a sense of what the year-round community is like there?
Yeah, it's about 600 people, and they have kids, you know. And those kids need to be educated. And, you know, one of the main logistical issues for the island is that the ferry schedule is limited after the summertime. You know, during the summer it runs once an hour pretty much all day. But the ferry schedule is reduced, you know, later in the fall and through the winter and through the spring. So that makes it difficult getting on and off the islands, and that presents a lot of issues as far as, you know, if you want to play a high school basketball game off the island, it probably requires an overnight stay because there's no ferry to take it back after the game. You know, so it's an interesting place to live year round, but it's definitely a unique place in Wisconsin.
Now, every school district has its own school funding story and probably problem, but talk about some of the unique issues facing school funding on Washington Island.
Yeah, they receive virtually no state funding. Many districts receive half and maybe a third of funding from the state. They get virtually none. So they need to pass a referendum every other year to meet their costs. So, you know, the residents there have stepped up. They could consolidate with another district, but, again, getting kids off the island to go to another school would be really difficult. It'd be about a two-hour commute to get kids from Washington Island to the Gibraltar School District, which is the next closest school district. So, they're voting every year to keep their kids on the island and to continue their local control.
Why do they get so little state funding? Is it because it's, you know, per student and there's not many students?
Rob, could you explain the state funding formula for me?
Well, yeah. Do we have an hour?
Yeah, it's not. It's a really a complex formula, but based on land values and property values and everything else. But, so it's a tough situation for them.
And I understand it can be difficult to attract teachers, probably because of the funding. How big a challenge is that to make sure they have teachers for all the roles they need?
Yeah, I mean, finding teachers, attracting teachers to any district now is a challenge. Act 10 has had an impact on that. And in some respects, Act 10 has helped some districts as far as reducing their costs. But now you've got a lot of new teachers in these roles. So it can be kind of it's a challenge for a district like Washington Island, because now you've got to attract someone to live there year round. So like you said, kind of in the beginning, you know, it's one thing to go on vacation to Washington Island and have fun, stay up there a couple days, maybe a week, but it's a very different story to live there year round. There's no movie theater. There's only a couple of bars and restaurants. There's only one grocery store. It's a very different way of life on the island during the winter.
Let's talk about life as a teacher or staff member there. It sounds like if I get a job in this school district, I'm going to be wearing a lot of different hats.
The Phi-Ed teachers, one Phi-Ed teacher was a carpenter on the island not that long ago, but he's also their tech ed teacher. The art teacher also teaches Phi-Ed. The school guidance counselor wears multiple hats. She does their cheer squad or pep squad, but she's also counseling kindergartners and seniors in high school and what colleges are going to go to. So, you wear a lot of different hats, including the superintendent, who's their superintendent, their principal, and their director of special education.
And there's one school, right? From all the kindergartners through the seniors are all in one building.
Yeah, there's one school building, and Maddie Palm-Lace, their superintendent, you know, one of the first thing he showed me, he says, here, stand in this spot in the school, and you can look down and see the high school, middle school, and elementary school through these different hallways there. So, yeah.
And talk about life as a student in the school at Washington Island.
Yeah, I mean, small class sizes. You know, you're going to know everybody in your school. Granted, they don't have a band, and there's a lot of things they don't have. But one of the things they do have is this tight-knit community where, everybody's going to know everybody, and kids can be involved with a lot of different things. And, you know, they're kind of kings of the school in a way, because you only got a couple people in your senior class. So there's opportunities for leadership.
So a lot of challenges there, but some good stuff too. I mean, what was the general attitude when you talked to teachers, parents, and students? Bummed, happy, where were they?
No, I think, they know what they're getting into, and I think they know where they live. They've chosen to live on the island for a reason, and for them, this is a way of life, and it's a way of life that they'd like to preserve. There's a lot of history up there, and There's a lot of beauty, and it's just it's a really a neat place to visit, and I think it'd be a really a neat place to live as well.
And if a magic wand were available, what's one change that you got the sense that people would want to see there at the school district?
I think they. When I was up there, I was actually up there to write a story about Plum Island, which is this little island off of Washington mm-hmm. Island, but they're doing some restoration work. So I wrote a story on that, and I figured, well, as long as I'm up there, I might as well write about the school district, which I've never written about but have always wanted to. Mm-hmm. And so when I went up there, they just happened to be having their annual school meeting where they approved the budget, which is only $1.5 million, by the way. Madison probably spends that on gas in a day for their school buses. One of the things they talked about at the annual meeting was the fact that, they don't have a school lunch program, but even if they did try to create one, it'd be like $250,000 to create a commercial kitchen, and then you'd have to staff it, you know. So I think there'd be a desire to have a hot lunch program, but realistically, it's probably not in the cards for them.
Well, Barry, thanks a lot for sharing your reporting with us today.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Hey, you bet, Rob.
That's Barry Adams. He covers regional and business news for the Wisconsin State Journal, and he joined us for a look at his reporting on Washington Island's school district. It's the smallest district in the state. Now, in the ongoing healthcare debate, we hear a lot about coverage, efficiency, cost containment. Our next guest says we need to make sure we don't overlook one of the most fundamental parts of medicine, the relationship between the doctor and the patient. In a world of high-technology medical equipment, a growing list of medications, and a huge healthcare bureaucracy, our guest calls for physicians and patients to keep that human connection at the center of medical care. How to do that? Her prescription is slow medicine. Dr. Victoria Sweet is the author of Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing. She's an associate clinical professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Sweet, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, your book, you tell the story of your medical career and really how it brought you to this concept of, and other people too, to the concept of slow mm-hmm. medicine. Let's start with, what do we mean by slow medicine?
Well, it's an interesting, it's sort of a countercultural concept, but it comes out of this whole slow movement and started out of the slow food movement, which of course started a long time ago. And a number of doctors, not just myself, about 15 years ago, started thinking about medicine in the same way as if we need slow food, we sure need slow medicine. So slow medicine, the way I think of it is, you might say, the opposite of our fast food model of healthcare that has overtaken us in probably the last 10 years or so. This idea that factory model, that you want to, buy cheap and sell high, this idea that healthcare is an industry and people should make money on it as opposed to being something where you take care of people when they're sick, this is kind of the essence of the matter. So it's in opposition. It's not so much that it's slower time-wise, but it has a different style in the same way that slow food has a different style from fast food and a different goal and a different object.
Right. How does that work differently for a doctor talking to a patient? As you say, it doesn't mean necessarily taking an hour that you probably don't have anyway, mm-hmm, but it's an attitude, it sounds like. How does that manifest itself?
It's a style. It does need a certain kind of time, mm-hmm, however. And so one of the things I've noticed in the past, one of the reasons I wrote this book is because I'm not a natural-born doctor. So for me, I didn't come from a family of docs, and medicine was kind of a strange world for me for a long time. And that made me a little bit naive in a good way, I think. And so I only gradually came to this conclusion that medicine is a relationship, and it's even a spiritual practice when done well. I came to it slowly, and what I came to was, first of all, so I was practicing all during this whole transition, and the more we talked about efficiency, the more I gradually realized that all the kinds of things that were instituted to make us more efficient actually made us less efficient, took more time, such things as the electronic health records, for instance, or these ideas that doctors should be follow algorithms, that they should collect big data for the healthcare companies. These ideas that are supposed to make us efficient actually makes us inefficient. And what I mean by that is, to me, the essence of efficiency in medicine is when I get the right diagnosis and the right treatment for the least amount of money. That's my definition of healthcare efficiency, and we're headed in the kind of opposite direction.
Right, you make the case, and you give a lot of examples of this, Dr. Sweet, where you know you follow that algorithm, you follow the procedure, and you end up with blinders on sometimes, or a doctor can end up with blinders. We lock in on one thing, and we miss the whole patient, we miss the whole story, and we miss, in some cases, the real diagnosis.
That happened a lot, because it turned out, the one reason I got to see this is I mostly practiced in kind of clinics for the poor, and the last place where I practiced the longest, I wrote a book about, which was called Laguna Honda Hospital in San Francisco, and I ended up there for 20 years, and it was a place that was over the hill to the poorhouse, where it was a big old hospital, where we didn't have a lot of technology. We had access to technology if we needed it. We're around the block from UC San Francisco's big hospital. But at the same time, we kind of weren't paid attention to in quite the same way as a doc in a private practice has had to pay attention himself to his bottom line. So I did have the time, the sort of free time, to examine my patient carefully, sometimes re-examine them, talk to the family, talk to the patient, get the old records. And what I found was I was more and more impressed as my career in medicine went on by how efficient that was in terms of not getting the wrong diagnosis and getting the right diagnosis. So I would have somebody come in. I'll give you one example. This particular patient came in. He was in his 50s. He came in because he'd been getting weaker and weaker, and he couldn't walk anymore, and he'd been at the technological hospital, the acute care hospital, for 2 months, and nobody had been able to figure out what was wrong with him. And I have this very old-fashioned, what I call my medical student exam from head to toe, that I do on all my patients. And the first thing after I greeted him, I put my hands on his head to examine from head to toe, and I found he had lumps, he had cancer on his scalp from, it turned out, to be a cancer in his esophagus that had metastasized all around his body but hadn't come out on any of the CT scans and the MRI scans, and nobody else had examined his head. So he had the wrong diagnosis, and then he had the right diagnosis, and he could get treated for the right diagnosis. And that was, you talk about efficient, that was about the most efficient procedure anybody could have done, but nobody did it, and nobody does it anymore because it takes time, and most doctors now in the pursuit of efficiency are stuck looking at their computers. And in the last 10 years, that has been, to me, that's kind of my bug in my ear now, because I see that most of my doctor friends spend literally all their time on their computers because all the records, of course, have migrated there. Everything's migrated there, and they don't have the time to swing their chair around and look, listen to, and examine their patient. Very simple.
Talking to Dr. Victoria Sweet. Her new book is Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing. Dr. Sweet, I want to take you to a moment in your training as a doctor. It's the midst of the AIDS crisis. I think you're in San Francisco at this point. Mm-hmm. You're thinking of leaving the profession. It's exhausting. It's overwhelming in some ways. And all of a sudden, something happens and you become a patient. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, I call that whole chapter turnaround, because it was a turnaround for me. So at the time, even more than now, being a medical resident, so being in the midst of your training, you have 4 years of medical school, then you have 3 years in the hospital. And it's gotten a little bit easier, but back then we would work 36 hours at a time. And I was at Kaiser in San Francisco right in the middle of the AIDS epidemic. So it was absolutely, and we had no treatment at the time yet for AIDS, so it was horrendous. We had literally lines of patients in that ER out the door, and people were dying all the time. And I had finally reached the end of my limit. I just couldn't do it anymore. I didn't see the point. It was one of those crises of conscience that we get now and then. I had decided to quit, even though that would mean I wouldn't finish my training. I just couldn't stand it anymore. And then one night, when I was turning this all over in my mind, I was in the hospital, and I crushed my finger in a door. I thought I'd amputated my finger. I collapsed. I passed out. Of course, I didn't know I passed out. And I woke up in the emergency room with one of the emergency room docs looking at me, and in the most compassionate way possible. And it was particularly important to me because this was an ER doc I didn't like. I couldn't stand him up until that moment. And he had sewed up my finger. He'd done the x-rays. By the time I woke up, I had an IV in. There were nurses around. And at that moment, lying there, looking to his face, I had a complete change of heart, because I realized that when you're a patient, this is what you need, and this is what I, as a doctor, get to do, is when I'm vulnerable, I'm a patient, I'm frightened, there's nothing I can do for myself, that's what the doctor's about, that's what the hospital's about, and that it's really a spiritual profession.
We're talking, go ahead.
Yeah, so at that point, I was like, no, I'm going to do this, and I did finish, and I've never lost that sense of being really moved by the practice of medicine and what it means in our society, particularly as we get more and more commodified, not just for medicine, but for everything. Everything becomes something to sell, to buy, to put up for sale, and not just medicine, but teachings like this, writings like this. All of our professions have gone this same way.
We're talking to Dr. Victoria Sweet. She's the author of the new book, Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing. She's an associate clinical professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. She's with us to talk about her book and why she says we need to shift our thinking when it comes to practicing medicine for the benefit of doctors and patients. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a doctor or other healthcare provider, a nurse, are you practicing medicine the way you wish you could? If you're a patient, what changes would you like to see when you visit your doctor? Do you feel like you're being treated as a whole person when you go for that appointment? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation about the doctor-patient relationship. Our guest is Dr. Victoria Sweet, author of the book Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the medical care you've gotten lately? Do you feel like the staff, the doctors, and others are paying attention to you, hearing you, seeing what's going on? If you work in healthcare, what do you like about how it works? What do you wish could change? What do you think of this idea of slow medicine? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. To your calls now, Tina is with us in Green Bay. Tina, hi.
Hi. I am an OB nurse, and about 5 years ago, I actually changed from bedside nursing to working for an insurance company as a case manager. So it's a very different type of practicing, but I spend my whole day talking with pregnant ladies, and I hear every day how they're very grateful because I take time to explain things and talk with them and answer their questions that their doctors never do because they just seem like they're so rushed and busy.
Tina, thanks for that call. And Dr. Sweet, the workload for doctors can make it hard to do some of the things you're talking about. Is that right?
Yes, yes. But it doesn't really have to be that way because we waste so much time. The thing that I've been focusing on recently is docs actually have the same time pretty much we always had per patient, which is about 15 minutes. And it used to take us, when we had our paper charts, a couple of minutes to write our notes. But since the efficient electronic health records entered our lives, it now takes anywhere doctors between 10 and 18 minutes to write that same note because they have to write it on the computer. Consequently, doctors are spending all their time navigating that instead of simply turning around. So my sort of piece right now is if we want our doctors to be able to turn their chair around once again, look at us, listen to us, and examine us, we have to get the time that they're spending on the computer back. And I think we can do that because the problem with the computer records is they're terrible. They're badly designed, and they suck all our time out, and they don't have to be that way. So I think we do have the time, but I think it's being wasted.
Tina, thanks for that call. Go next to Joshua in the Upper Peninsula. Joshua, hi.
Hi. I'm a practicing cardiologist in central Wisconsin, and I agree wholeheartedly with your assessment that the electronic record is a colossal waste of time, very frustrating, and at the end of most of my days, I feel like I've spent 95% of my time as a keyboard jockey, a computer programmer, and not a doctor.
Joshua, thanks a lot for calling and sharing your story. Isn't there a payoff, Dr. Sweet? I mean, when I'm a patient, they look at the records, they can look back at my tests and how they've done over the last bunch of years, or my last physical therapy exercise, they can print it off for me again. Is there a payoff, an upside to this?
There should be a payoff, and I don't think it's the electron's fault that there isn't. These are just very badly designed. So you should be able to do what you're talking about. And in fact, with paper records, we could also do that. But what's happened is the electronic medical records actually evolved out of a billing system from the 80s. So it is a very clumsy piece of code, and that's what needs to be changed. So we should be able to get all the benefits of electricity out of them, but we're not. What's happening is your caller, the cardiologist, was exactly right. There's been studies done to actually document this. The most recent study I know, Kaiser here in California, apparently, I heard this through the grapevine, wanted to see, because their doctors were all whining about how much time they spent on the computer, so Kaiser said, well, let's find out. So they actually kept track in two hospitals of their doctors' keystrokes for 2 months. They figured out exactly how much time their doctors were spending on the computer. And it turned out that when you took all those, added all those seconds up and divided by the number of doctors, that the doctors were spending 10 hours out of their 8-hour day on the computer, filling in boxes, typing in their passwords, waiting for the stuff to load. So that's what we have to fix, because we should be able to do what you're talking about, and it shouldn't be difficult to have a beautiful electronic health record. I imagine one that looks like an old-fashioned chart, but is made out of electricity, kind of like an e-book chart, where your doctor can write it in or talk into it or type into it or whatever he or she wants, and that we have artificial intelligence entering all the boxes if they need to be entered.
So how do we get to where you want to be from where we are now? How can we fix the electronic record? I guess that's a big step, but also change that attitude to a more of a slow medicine attitude.
Well, that's a beautiful question. And the good news is I've had the chance for the last 5 years since my first book, God's Hotel, came out to really go all over the world and talk to people, but also listen. And there, we think of the really, so that their medical students, the nursing students, the residents, they want to practice the way I'm talking about. So we don't have to convince them. We just have to give them the space to do it and then model and mentor that. So one of the reasons I wrote this particular book is because I wanted to capture what I meant, especially for the medical students, the nursing students, and policy people, because I think if you've not been sick yourself, you're not a doctor or nurse, and you've never been in the hospital, it doesn't seem so bad to practice healthcare as if it were fast food delivery. It's only once that happens. So I think we first have to get doctors back there, and nurses, and nurse practitioners, and physician assistants, everybody, back their time, their free time to do what I'm talking about. Then we need to make sure we haven't forgotten what that entails, that style, fundamentally, of just getting quiet, looking, observing, listening, examining, and then thinking. It's actually pretty simple.
We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Sweet, thanks a lot for spending the time with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you very much.
That's Dr. Victoria Sweet. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing. She's an associate clinical professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Still time to share your thoughts on the issues she's raised. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. A Green Bay alderman has been put under restrictions for his interactions with city employees. The rules now say at least two staff members must be present in meetings with Guy Zimmer. He contends the move is part of his contentious relationship with the mayor, who announced last week he won't run for another term. Patty Murray reports.
It's safe to say there's no love lost between veteran Green Bay City Alderman Guy Zimmer and Mayor Jim Schmidt. This is Mr. Zimmer.
I mean, of all the people I've worked with in politics, over this really 42-year career. I mean, this guy is the absolute worst.
The United States of America. And to the republic for which it stands.
Zimmer's been a council member for around 40 years. Jim Schmidt's been mayor since 2003. Last week, he announced he won't seek another term.
Every day, we ask you to be with us and strengthen us.
Schmidt led an invocation at last week's city council meeting.
Let us be mindful of your gifts. You've given each of us the gifts of wisdom, patience, and understanding. Need to be with
any amicable relationship between Schmidt and Zimmer might be wishful thinking. Politically, they clash over downtown development, but a long-standing personal disagreement has led to the new restrictions. The Green Bay City Attorney, Vanessa Chavez, issued a rule in October that Zimmer can't meet with employees one-on-one. He's the only official the rule applies to.
Most recently, there were some interactions with members of the clerk's office, where he was really kind of frustrated and his behavior was kind of declining.
Chavez says the incidents were related to disrespect and incivility.
None of the actions that occurred recently rise to the level of somebody putting their hands on somebody else. So we're, thank goodness, not dealing with something like that. No, we are talking about, really, we're talking about an issue of civility.
She says employees complained about Zimmer's name-calling and yelling. Any meetings between the aldermen and employees must now be held in an office, not in a public space, and that at least two other people be present.
To my knowledge, I do not think that this is actions that have ever been taken, but this is not something that's new for municipalities. It's action that would be taken in any instance if you had a member of the public who was, you know, causing problems within City Hall.
The situation could hurt the city financially.
It would be more funny if it weren't so serious.
UW Green Bay political scientist David Helpap says the feud could hinder development projects, such as a mixed-use baseball stadium and a downtown hotel. He says even in the country's politically divided times, Green Bay is unusual.
Unfortunately, it seems like Green Bay is in a unique position among even Wisconsin communities and communities of its size with regard to these types of personal issues in the council chambers.
If that makes some people feel uncomfortable, well, that's their problem, not mine.
That's Zimmer's take as he plans for running again. Green Bay could be spared more argument since Zimmer's nemesis, Mayor Schmidt, isn't running for another term himself. Patty Murray, Wisconsin Public Radio.